Okay, I'm Barry Segrin.
All right, Barry, today we're going to talk about Schaefer. I know that you knew him well. So tell me how you met Schaefer. Were you a Christian or a non-Christian at the time?
I first encountered him in the autumn of 1965 when I was a first-year student at Covenant Seminary and still quite a new Christian. I'd become a Christian in 1964 after university and gone to Covenant just thinking I was going for a year just to learn something because I was ignorant. And he came through and did a series of lectures. He lectured for about 2 weeks, morning and afternoon, and gave what was first the Wheaton Lectures and later became The God Who Is There. And so I met him first in that context as a first-year student.
And you were a Christian?
Yes.
So apparently a new Christian?
I'd been converted in the summer of 64.
Okay. So what stands out, what you heard when you listened to Schaefer? What was standing out? What caught your attention?
Well, I think he blew us all away. A very dynamic, very authoritative, quite charismatic guy. And all the things he was talking about were completely new to us, and I think completely new to the evangelical scene in America, more or less. And the way I've often put it is that at Covenant, I was getting a good education in Greek and Hebrew and church history and theology and New Testament, Old Testament, all this good stuff. But I thought Schaefer opened the doors a lot wider, because he was asking, how do we know all this stuff is true? And then, if it's true, how does it apply just to all of life, to the whole world, to politics, to philosophy, to theater, to poetry, to, you know, how can we see things through Christian glasses, through biblical glasses? And this was a revelation.
Yes, you speak about he opened the doors. I've heard that from a number of people that I have interviewed. They speak of him as the great door opener.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's an interesting phrase. So you met him in 65, fall of 65.
Yeah.
So that would have been the same time that he had delivered the lectures at Wheaton.
As I said, that was just after he'd yes. been to Boston.
Yes.
He'd been to Wheaton and given yes. the same series of lectures.
Yes.
Then he came and gave it at Covenant, and it was later published as The God Who Is There.
Yes. So did you keep in touch with Schaefer over the years? Did you go to Labrie?
Well, the other thing I'll add about my experience then, I say we were all bowled over by what this guy was doing. A lot of people didn't quite know what to make of it. And I wrote it all down and fed it all back on the exam and got an A for the course. And a couple of years later, after I'd been to Labrie for a summer and heard him say it all endless times more,
yes.
I remember going back and looking at my notes and realized I hadn't got it.
Hmm.
I'd just written down the words.
Yes.
But my understanding at that point was really quite superficial. I'd written it down, but I didn't really get it. And that's why I've always told people who are interested in going to Labrie, go for as long as you can. As I said, what Schaefer had to offer isn't a new set of doctrines or a new set of techniques or how to do this or how to do that. His word was always mentality. And it's things you can't just write it down. This is what Schaefer taught. is something that needs to seep into your bones over time and really shape how you look at things and how you think and function as a Christian. And I think that's what happened to me over time.
Yes.
Not at the first exposure. He came through Covenant again in 66, my second year there. And then Covenant encouraged us all to take a year out between second and third years, work in the church, learn something practical. And the church I chose to work in was in Willow Grove, Pennsylvania. And Richard Gray, the pastor, was quite interested in Schaefer. And when we were talking about my possibly coming, he said, "Well, what would you think about going to LaBrie for the summer and coming back and working for us for the year?" And I jumped at it. So he got a lawyer in his congregation who put out $500, and that covered my plane flight and my student fees. So I was sent to LaBrie on scholarship. So I was there for 3 months, summer of 67. Met my wife there. We got married that winter. Went back, finished my last year at Covenant. And then in thinking and praying about what to do next, we had both been very much shaped by the Schaefers and LaBrie. Veronica was a close friend of Susan Schaefer's and still is. And we thought, well, what about LaBrie? So when the Schaefers came through that year, they seemed to come through Covenant just about every year, we talked with them and said we were interested in coming for who knows how long, a couple of years maybe. And so we did, and so we went to, rolled up in Waymo as workers in the spring of 69, were there for 10 years, and then we and Dick and Marty Kies started the LaBrie in Southboro, and we were there for about 4.5 years. Then we came to Gretham, and were there for about 8.5 years, and by 92, I was burnt out as far as LaBrie work, and we left LaBrie not on any bad terms at all, but still, we live 5 miles from Gretham.
Yes.
So we're still on very good terms with LaBrie, and I still am eager to say that Schaefer was the formative influence on me as a Christian and in many ways as a person.
So as you followed, being working in LaBrie, you followed along with Schaefer. Did you see, I don't know precisely when it happens, but Schaefer becomes a pretty popular fellow. It starts after 65 with the Wheaton lectures, but then the God Who's There, I think Escape from Reason came out first. Mm-hmm. And then the God Who Was There. And by that time, we're starting to see Schaefer become
well accepted. That
was in 69. Yes.
Because I remember I graduated from Covenant in 69, and my wife and I were traveling to Switzerland to start at LaBrie and traveled through England to see her family. And I remember being up here in London and seeing in the bookshops, in the window, the God Who Is There and Escape from Reason. Anyway, the first of the books.
Yes.
I saw that in the bookshops. And when we got to LaBrie, traditionally LaBrie had been quiet much of the year and then busy in the summer. So summer of 69 was busy, 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 as we expected. And then we were told that things will get quiet down now. So we put away some of the extra beds. We went off on holiday, came back, all the extra beds had been put back up again, and the place was busy, busy, busy from then on.
So then he does the How Should We Then Live. By this time, his notoriety, not so much yet in the United States. I mean, there was, as you know, there were a good number in the evangelical world that were suspicious of Schaefer.
More, oh, yes.
They were not quite sure. And mm-hmm. He had long hair, and that had become sort of as a trademark of rebellion. And so how could he speak for the truth of Christianity? But does that, all of this speaking that he has to do now and popularity because of, I think the How Should We Then Live was pretty formative for a number of people.
Yeah.
As Schaeffer starts doing something that had not been done, at least as my understanding, not much of it had been done, or that we would more likely call his intellectual history, connecting the dots throughout history. So did that change anything in Schaeffer's relation to LaBrie? Or, I mean, he was traveling a lot, so did that have any effect?
Very much. I think we were next door neighbors for about the first 3 years or so, because they were living in the big house at Melez. We were living next door in Beauceit. And they were doing everything. Just whatever happened at LaBrie, he did it. Discussion meals all the time. He did many of the lectures. He did always did the Saturday night discussion. He did the student seminar. He preached on Sunday morning. He saw people. They were fully engaged. But then as they became more popular and more invitations to speak and more writing, they bought a house up in Chesier, just a mile up the road, and moved up there in about 72. And that certainly removed him a good step from the daily work. Now he was still, when he was in town, he was always at the workers' meetings, so he was still very much in charge and very much involved. I mean, when he was in town, they had meals up at their house, he did the lectures, he did Sunday morning preaching. But he was a step removed up there in Chesier, and increasingly involved in traveling and speaking and writing.
Do you think that had any impact on the work at LaBrie?
No, not straight away, because he and Mr. Schaeffer, they still were LaBrie, and they really set the ethos there. And so no, I think in terms of just what went on, what the students got out of their time there, stayed more or less the same for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And of course, nobody was Schaeffer's successor.
Right.
Nobody could fill his boots. I mean, Os Guinness, probably more than anybody.
Yes.
So there's no one who took on the sort of the worldwide ministry that he began to have. But as far as what went on for the students day by day, I think that continued.
So living at LaBrie, close to the Schaeffers, what stands out in your memory about Schaeffer the man?
I say dynamic. Both of them, ball of energy. Mrs. Schaeffer even more so. She was inexhaustible, and always talking and always on the go. They were very, very different temperaments. You felt that Edith Schaeffer had a hotline to God, and you know, six answered prayers and three miracles every day before breakfast, and every airplane flight she took, she came back with a story about talking to somebody. I couldn't cope with that. I think Schaeffer was different. When I was leading the chapel service at LaBrie, if he was in town, I'd always ask him to pray. Just because he prayed in a very moving way, and it ministered to me. And I remember a phrase he often used. He said, "These things so easily slip through our fingers." And I think for him, the sort of experiential reality of God, sometimes, sometimes not. And I think he was a depressive. I think he had to fall back at times on his sort of intellectual certainty that this was true. And that helped me, and lots of us. Mm-hmm. So there were real contrasts in that way. But very, very intense. He had a temper which he had learned to control. And so none of us were ever on the receiving end of his temper. I think he knew his faults. He was always very open about just his own personal weaknesses and struggles. And I think one of them was temper. I think another of them was just the tendency to be depressive. It was Mr. Schaefer, if anything, who bore the brunt of that. He could be awfully rude to her. She would never stop talking, just never stop talking. Sometimes he'd just cut her dead. He could be awfully rude to her, but for the rest of us, I think he'd learn to control it.
So as you think about his ideas, as you say, you not only heard them, but they be settled in your soul and began to shape how you thought, how you looked, how you perceived the world. What do you think were some of the key ideas of Schaefer?
Huge emphasis on people being made in God's image, of that being the only explanation for what he would call the mannishness of man.
Yes.
Just why are people unique? Why are they special? Why is human life valuable? So huge emphasis on people being made in the image of God. Huge emphasis on the fall as a real event in space-time history, as he always put it. This being really the only way we can understand evil and suffering. You know, how can we look at the world as we see it and still say that God is good? And I still feel that that's absolutely central. And people who begin to take a soft line on the historicity of Genesis, I think once they lose the historic fall, they lose any real way to understand evil and suffering. So that was huge. His confidence in the scriptures, he was a Bible guy through and through, you know, inerrancy of scripture. And just Christianity is truth. True truth was always his phrase, not Christian truth or religious truth or my truth or your truth, but the truth of the way things actually are.
Yes, he would actually, often I've read, not hear him say, well, sometimes, but that Christianity is true because it's true to what is there.
That's right.
Yeah. And he would make that point. You talk about being made in the image of God, so that's how he understood the fall, made in the image of God, to explain how man could be cruel, but also how he could do wonderful things. Mm-hmm. He could do a great work of art. He could do compassionate works.
Yeah.
Did you ever hear him talk about in evangelism, this idea that when you see a person in front of you, think first that it's a person made in the image of God, not as a sinner? Now, I remember reading that, and it really changed much in how I looked at the whole evangelism thing. That, you know, if you saw it a person first, that would have some way of shaping how you engage that person. Do you think, do you remember anything along those lines?
Well, I do remember. He was a remarkable pastor. in the sense that he took everybody seriously. When you were with him and talking with him, you never felt he had a million other things to do, even though he did.
Yes.
He took everybody seriously, and whether it was some well-known Christian leader who'd come to visit or just the most lost American backpacker who wandered in, he took people seriously, took their questions seriously. I remember one Saturday night discussion where it went on and on and on and on, and finally developed into just a conversation between Schaefer and this non-Christian, young non-Christian guy. And after a while, the non-Christian guy just broke in and said, "Why are you doing this?" And Schaefer said, "Because I don't want you to go to hell." And that was, I've never forgotten that.
Mm.
And he was good with people. He was just never light. He was always serious. Always took people seriously. Always treated them as individuals made in God's image.
His understanding of apologetics, his notion of pre-evangelism, would you have anything to say about that?
When I was at Covenant, there's a lot of discussion about apologetics and presuppositional apologetics is in Van Til and Westminster, and then evidential apologetics. And where did Schaefer fit in? And I concluded that he was an evidentialist, but what interested him or what he wanted to focus on was the evidence of ideas. He wasn't interested in archaeological proof and fulfilled prophecy and historical accuracy of the Bible and the evidence for the resurrection. I'm sure he could talk about all that, but that was never his focus. It was always the evidence of ideas. Christianity is a system of thought. Every philosophy, every religion is a system of thought. It's a set of spectacles that helps us to see the world. And does Christianity as a system of thought make sense of us and the world we live in? That was always the nature of his argument. And I think it still is. That certainly shaped me very definitely. How can we understand this world? Its beauty, its fallenness, the uniqueness of man, the sinfulness of man, all these things, how can we understand it? And it's only the Christian framework of ideas that enables us to do so. And sometimes he would use the word presuppositions for that.
Mm-hmm.
The Westminster folk, when they used the word presupposition, I thought they meant an axiom, something you just have to accept. It's where you start. You can't go behind it.
Yes.
And I think it caused confusion for some, because Schaefer would sometimes use the word presupposition.
Yes.
But he didn't mean it as an axiom. He meant it as sort of the basic ideas of the Christian faith. God is there as an infinite personal God. He's created human beings in his image. The fall is a real event, so on and so forth. These were his presuppositions in the sense of the basic ideas of the Christian faith, which he was hugely willing to discuss and defend and show that, these fit the world we live in a way that other sets of ideas do not.
Yes, I think it's in the God who was there. I think we probably read this in the five-volume set, because I think he did some additions, particularly in the God who was there. But he says presuppositions don't just fall to the air.
Okay.
That there's reasons why we have these, and they can be challenged. Whereas I think what your understanding maybe of more of the Vantillian view is they were just starting points that were not to be.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't to be scrutinized. They were the starting point. And if you couldn't start there, then it's almost difficult to talk to you. That's right. Yes.
Yeah. Yes, I remember leading a Saturday night discussion once and being taken to task afterwards by a couple of guys who were Westminster students.
Yes.
Because I'd been trying to argue.
Mm-hmm.
One of the illustrations that he used that stuck with me was the torn book illustration. He said, if you have a book,
yes,
and it's been torn down the middle, and you just have one half of it, or take a paper, just have one half of it, the other half you don't have. He said two things would be true. First of all, you'd know that it wasn't nonsense. There is a coherent book here. There is something here that makes sense. But the other thing is you wouldn't be able to fill in the missing half of every line and have the whole book. However, if you were to find the other half in an attic somewhere, you could put the two together and verify that, yes, this is the missing half that fits the book I have. And now you could read the whole book. And that was his approach to, of course, the world in which we live is the half book we have.
Yes.
And the Bible is the half book that we find, that we can see by thinking about it. Yes, they fit. Mm. Now I've got a whole book.
What was your background? What had you studied prior to going to Covenant?
My degree was in physics and mathematics.
Okay.
And I had always planned to go on and do a PhD in physics, but I was sort of fed up with studying when I finished university and took a year out to work. Got a job as an aerospace engineer down in Huntsville.
Mm-hmm.
And during that year, I was converted, and my life changed directions.
Mm. People that, maybe not people who are negative towards Schaeffer, but will say, Schaeffer wasn't a philosopher. My understanding is Schaeffer never pretended to be a philosopher in a professional way. What would be your response?
I'd agree. Yeah, and people get very annoyed with him for making these huge generalizations. No, he was very clear. He wasn't an academic specialist in any discipline. I used to get annoyed with him with his exegesis at times, because I was, the study of the New Testament was something that interested me more and more,
mm-hmm.
and I'd get very annoyed with his sort of cavalier generalizations. And he never pretended to be an academic expert or specialist. And to me, the question was not whether he has one sentence to summarize Kant, but whether that's an accurate sentence or not. And I think he had a remarkable gift for putting his finger on the nub of the issue. So whether it was where society was going or what these various philosophers and artists and whatnot were saying, I thought his gift was just for putting his finger on the heart of it. And yes, some people were annoyed with his generalizations.
But he did what he intended to do, and that is to show, as he would say, the flow of history.
Yep.
The dots were connected. So the generalization, while maybe not at, every point of which he makes was precisely as it should have been, the general thought was there.
Mm, yeah.
And it helped to show how things fit together.
Mm, yeah.
And yeah. I think that was, from my perspective, that was the genius.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And then other people, took his perspective and his approach and then applied it in more detail in whatever field they were in. I mean, Oz Guinness in what you call it, sociology, and other people in other areas. So I think other people followed his lead and worked out in more detail things that he'd painted in broad brush.
So you sat under Schaefer as a pastor for a while?
Yes, I was exposed to him a lot. I say we were 10 years in Swiss Le Bris, 3 years as neighbors. I sat in on endless workers' meetings and members' meetings and trustees' meetings and in the church, elders' meetings and synod meetings. I couldn't begin to count how many meetings I sat in with him.
Would he have been directive when he was having, let's say, you're having Le Bris workers' meetings and there needs to be something done, something that a decision needs to be made? Would he have been directive and say, this is what we need to do, or would he have approached it another way?
We were all the younger generation, so we didn't pretend that we were sharing this with the Schaefers. I think the Schaefers did a remarkable job of sharing it with us. Mm-hmm. But I remember in workers' meetings, you know, 15 of us in the room, and he'd be lying on the floor, and arguments would be swirling around. And at a certain point, he'd sit up and say, let me see if I can pull together what you've all been saying. And then we'd have we'd move forward. So he gave us all a lot of freedom. I was never told how to preach, how to lecture, how to lead a discussion. I think there could have been more training and support. But it was a huge freedoms. But he knew what he wanted. And at times, he wasn't shy about giving a lead and making a decision.
So you have the benefit of early days with Schaefer, and now we're living in the 21st century. Do you think that people understand Schaefer well today, or do you think he has just been dismissed?
Mixture. When I was a pastor here for 12 years, retired 12 years ago, and I got quite involved with Proclamation Trust. I used to go to EMA and used to go to the smaller ministers' conferences. That was sort of that was where I found my kindred spirits. And I was amazed how often, in just talking with the other guys about their own background, they'd say, well, I read Schaefer when I was a theological student and it really had a big impact on me. That came up more often than I expected, because as you look at the church scene here, you don't see, you know, it seems that now he's completely forgotten, and lots of people haven't a clue. But I was amazed how many of the guys I bumped into in Proc Trust spoke very warmly of just reading his stuff as students, or maybe they'd been out to Le Bris, and been just strongly affected by it.
Do you think there is a maybe some sort of a just human inclination, I suppose, that we are affected by somebody, let's say Schaefer, and it means a lot to us at the time, and in the future, as we look back, we think, yeah, that was wonderful, but it hasn't really impacted what people are really doing now. Do you think there's any truth to that?
It certainly impacted me.
Yes.
In a permanent way. And I find still in discussions and preaching and all sorts, I'm quoting Schaefer more often than I should, because it's... Yeah, he shaped me.
Yeah.
Most people, you know, our church has always had a close connection with Le Bris. And I've always felt there was a good two-way street there, that our church was a good church home for Labrie workers, and that Labrie was a good resource and influence on us. And I always wanted that thing to be as strong as I could, both when I was in Labrie and when I was in the church. Most of our church people, I would say, haven't a clue. And I can see why, just because of my own personal experience. So the first time I heard Schaefer, you know, writing it all down, yes, passing the exam, and coming back a few years later and seeing, nah, I'd just written the words, I hadn't really got it. And so I find for many people in our church who would speak very warmly and highly of Labrie, we're a Labrie church, this mm-hmm. is really important to us. No, as to what's in their bones, not much.
Well, as we bring this to a close, anything, any event, story happening that you've told us a couple, that you think of often, that rather an endearing event, encounter with Schaefer.
Oh dear. I'll tell you a couple from early days. When my wife and I got engaged in 67, they had a little party for us, the students did, at one of the houses, and Schaefer dropped in. Mm-hmm. And they both did. And he started singing, who put the something in Mrs. Murphy's chowder? And if you cannot hear me, I'll sing a little louder. Who put the umpty-dump in Mrs. Murphy's chowder? Much to the embarrassment of Mrs. Schaefer and to the hilarity of the rest of us. We just didn't know he had that in him, because he was normally just very serious. And there was one evening, he never made fun of people. He never said you had a dumb question. But there's one night, I think he couldn't help himself. It was in a discussion in the downstairs of Malaise, and a guy at the back was speaking, and he said, "Oh, sorry, I couldn't see you through Hans's beard." Well, Hans was this very young German fellow who was a student at Labrie, who was trying to grow a beard, and he had the most pathetic, wispy thing you could ever imagine. But that was a one-off. I expect Schaefer apologized to him afterwards.
Well, I appreciate, Barry, this so much. As we're trying to give a context for people as they read Schaefer today, and also in an attempt to bring Schaefer not as an icon, not as something that we worship, but because we think that his ideas are very pertinent mm. for the hour in which we live, mm. and that it would be a shame for us not, those of us who have some appreciation yeah. for Schaefer. Yeah. And I think that it may be true that the church is in maybe even more need of Schaefer's approach, his understanding today, than maybe even the day in which he spoke things.
I think he's, I don't know about more or less relevant, but still very relevant. Mm-hmm. I find the particulars in his books have dated, you know, the illustrations he yes. used. Mm-hmm. But the general approach, the basic ideas, the mentality, hugely important. Hugely important.